It's high noon on the wet coast of Vancouver. Welcome to the local Brown Bagger Show here on CFRO Co-op Radio, 102.7 FM in Vancouver. Many fear that capitalism will fail to respond to climate change and the general destruction of our ecosphere. Ian Angus, author and educator, says our only alternatives are eco-socialism or barbarism. Get the latest on eco-socialist organizing from this speech by Ian Angus in Vancouver, November 16, 2007, at Simon Fraser University. What happened at the first ever international organizing meeting in Paris this October? Find out. Ian Angus has been a social activist since the 1960s. He writes frequently for left-wing publications in Canada like New Dimension and Socialist Voice. Angus is the editor of the online journal Climate and Capitalism, director of the Socialist History Project, and a founding member of the new Eco-Socialist International Network. Here is Ian Angus with Eco-Socialism, where anti-capitalism and ecology intersect.
I want to thank Vancouver Socialist Forum and the New Socialist Group and the International Socialists for inviting me here and for organizing this meeting. This is really great. I don't get to Vancouver nearly often enough. This is my hometown. And I have lots of relatives here, so I hardly ever come.
Is that why?
Yeah, that's why, actually, yes. This is not a talk about global warming and all those issues. There's lots to be said about that. I mainly want to talk about the movement globally. But I want to start off, because you might not have seen the news, this has not been widely reported in Canada yet today, but the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the UN body that studies this question, is currently meeting in Valencia, Spain, to produce the final summary for 2007. They do these every 4 years. And as you know, they've been putting out reports this year, and the point of this one is to be the final summary after there's been debate all year about their other reports and so on. And early this morning, Spain time, they finally agreed on a draft, which will be actually voted on tomorrow. Just a couple of sentences from it, from this report on it. They agreed that the rise in Earth's temperatures observed in the past few decades was principally due to human causes, not natural ones, as some skeptics claim. By 2100, global average surface temperatures could rise between 1 and 6.4 degrees centigrade Celsius compared to 1980 to 1999 levels. Sea levels will rise between 18 and 59 centimeters. And by the way, that's generally by scientists now considered to be a very conservative estimate. That's assuming that Antarctica and Greenland don't melt. Heat waves, rainstorms, drought, tropical cyclones, and surges in sea level are among the events expected to become more frequent, more widespread, or more intense in this century. Water shortages, hunger, flooding, and damage to homes will be a heightened threat. All countries will be affected, says the IPCC, but those bearing the brunt will be poor countries, which also bear the least responsibility for the problem. It could also lead, they believe, to massive population resettlement, especially to urban areas that may not have the capacity to shelter, feed, and employ them. And I think that's a significant understatement. So that's where we are at the beginning of the 21st century. The world is suffering from a fever due to climate change, and the disease is the capitalist development model. That was the opening sentence of a truly remarkable letter that was sent to the United Nations on September the 24th by Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia, the first indigenous head of state in Latin America. That letter and the speech he made at the UN session on climate change that same day are really powerful statements and powerful examples of a very important development. The convergence of the new rise of mass anti-capitalist struggles in Latin America with the rise of movements and political views that can be called eco-socialist. This is an exciting development. I'm going to spend a lot of time on that in this talk. The left internationally needs to understand it, and it's particularly in the advanced countries, the wealthy countries, we need to understand it, identify with it, and support it, and see how we can deal with it in our own countries, as you said. Fix things up on your side too, right? I'm going to return to that subject. What I want to do this evening is talk about, give you a brief report on the International Eco-Socialist meeting that was held in Paris in October. Then I want to discuss eco-socialism as a body of ideas and as a global movement. And I'll finish with a summary of what I think are the main tasks that face eco-socialists in Canada in the coming year or so. I hope there will be a lot of time for questions and discussion. On October 7th and 8th, in a working-class suburb of Paris, about 60 eco-socialist activists from 13 countries met. It was the first meeting of its kind ever held. Now, for obvious reasons, the largest number of participants came from Europe, particularly from England, but there were people there from Argentina, Australia, Belgium, Brazil. You can read it yourself, a substantial list of people. In addition, we received expressions of support from activists in about a dozen other countries, including many in the global south, who were unable to attend. This was not an academic meeting or an educational gathering. That was not what we were getting together to do. Our goal was entirely practical. It was to begin laying the basis for global collaboration and communication among eco-socialists. As several of us said in advance, we'll know it's a successful meeting if we can actually agree to meet again. And that, in fact, was our goal, to begin the work of planning a major international conference on this subject. I'm pleased to say that we did that. As I arrived in Paris, the two things I was most afraid of, I was on the initiating committee, was either that it would be so big that we didn't fit into the room we had, and I wasn't very afraid of that, or that it would be so small that it was embarrassing. And it wasn't either of those. I'm glad to say it went very well, and we did agree to meet again. The main decisions we made: we will hold a major international eco-socialist conference in Brazil in January of 2009 in conjunction with the next World Social Forum. It was a big, overwhelming sentiment in the meeting that the next meeting should be held in the Global South and that Brazil was the place to go. But because we also had substantial attendance from Europe at this meeting, we agreed that we would hold a regional conference in Europe, probably in late spring and probably in Greece. We selected a coordinating committee to prepare for the 2008-2009 conferences. We agreed to launch a website, which now exists, ecosocialistnetwork.org, and an online discussion forum, which also exists. If you're interested in either, you can go to that website, and if you click on contact, you'll find out about how to join the discussion group. Fairly low volume so far, but it's going to go. We selected a three-member committee to draft a new eco-socialist manifesto. Two of the members of the initiating committee, Joel Koval and Michael Lowy, were the people who drafted the original eco-socialist manifesto that came out in the year 2001. They, in particular, and everybody else in the room, agreed that it was far out of date, needed substantial work. So we are currently drafting a new one. It will go online sometime in the next month or two for international discussion. We're going to use all the tools at our disposal, wikis and the rest, so that people can edit it globally. And the goal is to adopt it in Brazil or do whatever with it in Brazil when we get there. And we adopted a working name. And I have to tell you that the single most intense and bitter discussion was what the name should be. And it gets weirder because the debate was over, should it be the Eco-Socialist International Network or the International Eco-Socialist Network? And the wrong one won, and I'm furious. Anyway, it's brand new. The Eco-Socialist International Network has no revenue, no dues structure, and no formal rules. Our goal was to begin collaboration, so we didn't begin by creating a huge structure. Anybody who considers herself or himself an eco-socialist is welcome to take part, in fact, encouraged to do so. It is entirely dependent on the support and commitment of volunteers. There's no, as I say, no due structure, no method of, the way you get in is by taking part. So its long-term success is very far from certain. It's only, it's been barely 6 weeks since we had this meeting, 5 weeks. But it's off to a good start, and I'm hoping to see more Canadian involvement in the coming months. So that's the Eco-Socialist International Network. The question that seems to come up most often when I discuss this, especially with left-wing audiences, is why eco-socialism? Why not just socialism? And after all, people like John Bellamy Foster and Paul Burkett and others have done wonderful work showing that Marx was and Engels were deeply concerned about humanity's relationship with nature, and Marxism has always, although the word ecology did not exist in their time, the concepts did, and they were very committed to them. There are what we would today call ecological ideas are deeply embedded in Marxist writings. In the right up until the late 1920s, there was a very active and influential ecology movement in the Soviet Union. So why do we need a new word? New words are always, what are you doing that for? Well, it's true that Marxism does have a terrific heritage here. But it's also true that during the 20th century, socialists tended to forget or ignore their own tradition in this area. Socialists of all political currents. And they supported, adopted, in some places implemented, approaches to economic growth and to development that were grossly harmful to the environment. And the ecological records of the Soviet Union, of China, are certainly, many people would agree to that. And even in the countries where capitalism remained in effect in North America, if you read what was written during that the past century, so a great deal of it was certainly insensitive to ecological issues, at least not aware of them. So one reason for using the term eco-socialism is simply to signal loud and clear that we view ecology and climate change not just as another stick to beat capitalism with, but as a critically important issue, one of the principal problems facing humanity in this century. So that's one reason for using the term. But there's more in that involved. Marxism is not a fixed set of eternal truths. It's not a set of rules that were laid down in the 19th century and they never change. It's a living body of thought, a method of understanding society, and a tool for social change. Socialists who don't evolve to incorporate new social and scientific insights become irrelevant sectarians. And we've seen that happen to many individuals and groups over the years. You know, Marx and Engels, if you look at their lives, they constantly were reading the science of their day and trying to see how it would fit in with their views. They both paid close attention to Liebig, who was the great 19th century expert on soil fertility, to Morgan, Lewis Morgan on early society, to Darwin on evolution, and to many others. And they evolved their ideas as science evolved. They were intensely interested. So Marxists today have to do that same thing. We have to learn from this great science of our own day. Eco-socialism is Marxism enhanced by the thoughts and analysis of modern ecology. It is, of course, a relatively new term for a relatively new political development, and different people use the term in different ways. I should be clear, these are my views today. The Eco-Socialist International Network doesn't even have a policy on these things. We've just agreed to start working together. So this is my take on it. Different people use the word in different ways, and they often put quite different content into it. What's more, like the shorter word socialism, eco-socialism is used for three different but related things. It's a goal, a global eco-socialist society. It's a body of political, economic, and social thought that combines socialist and ecological ideas. And it's a movement, a growing number of activists worldwide who believe, although most of them would not use this phrase, that the only way to stop ecological destruction is through what the authors of the Communist Manifesto called, in a phrase I truly love, despotic inroads on the rights of property and on the conditions of bourgeois production. And that's not a slogan you put up on a sign and carry around. Doesn't buy you much. Stand in the street corner, you're going to get looked at. But it's a concept that the way we are going to solve the ecological problems is by placing severe restrictions on the conditions of bourgeois production.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You're listening to Ian Angus on eco-socialism.
As a goal, eco-socialism aims to replace capitalism with a society in which profit is no longer the driving economic force, in which common ownership of the means of production has replaced capitalist ownership, and in which the preservation and restoration of ecosystems is central to all activity. Now, those statements are pretty general. They reflect the long-standing Marxist tradition refusal to engage in utopian speculation about the course of future history. We don't know exactly the circumstances or the timing under which socialism will come about, so to try and say exactly how it's going to happen is mostly guesswork. Marx said this as he said he would not write recipes for the chefs of the future. And Rosa Luxemburg said, really the best we can do is erect signposts that point towards the future, not maps. And she said, even though signposts are mostly negative, they're mostly criticisms of the present order rather than clear descriptions of the new society. Now, obviously, we need a broad vision of what we're fighting for. And I've talked a little bit about that, and many of us have more things that we think would be typical of an eco-socialist society. But our focus is on relentless criticism of the existing destructive order and on building movements that can actually implement and impose those despotic inroads on the rights of property that will ultimately bring the system down and create a new one. As a body of ideas, eco-socialism argues that ecological destruction is not an accidental feature of capitalism. It is built into the system's DNA. It's fundamental to how capitalism works. This system's insatiable need to increase profits, what Foster has called, John Bellamy Foster, is another phrase I like, what he calls the ecological tyranny of the bottom line, that can't be reformed away. That capitalism is a system that by its nature causes ecological damage and destruction. If you're interested in Marxism and socialist theory, one of the most exciting developments, in fact, in the past few years has been a new wave of Marxist scholarship dealing with ecology. A dozen or more books, hundreds of essays and articles have come out in the past decade or so. Books like Joel Coville's The Enemy of Nature, John Bellamy Foster's Ecology Against Capitalism and Marx's Ecology, James O'Connor's Natural Causes. Those books belong on every socialist reading list, and that is just a beginning. You know, a few years ago, the problem in this area was that it was hard to find anything to read. The problem now is to figure out where to start. And if you want advice, a good place to start actually is Ecology Against Capitalism by John Bellamy Foster, a really good collection of essays. Of course, there are far more non-Marxist books on the subject, but there's an intriguing, I'm convinced this is a whole new genre of books, and this is books that do really well for the first 19 chapters and fall apart in the 20th. Book after book brilliantly describes the problem and the looming catastrophe, and then tells us that the solution is to change our light bulbs, or vote for carbon taxes. Not bad ideas, but hopelessly inadequate to the problem that they themselves describe. Where Marxism is consistently superior is in explaining why capitalism is fouling up our world. At the root, global warming is not caused by stupidity. It's not caused by short-sighted decision makers or by outdated pro-growth ideology. It's caused by capitalism's insatiable need to increase profit. Anyone who doesn't understand that, and sadly that's true of the authors of most of the books you get to read, doesn't understand global warming and can't offer meaningful solutions to it. Now, I also have to stress that when you read the new Marxist writing on ecology, this new wave, you'll see that the Marxist wing of the green movement, or the green wing of the Marxist movement, depending on how you want to say it, is very far from homogeneous. One of the most important areas, for example, is disagreements regarding the role of the working class and its role in changing society. Joel Covell, who I have great admiration for, argues that there is, quote, no privileged agent of ecological transformation. And he says that an eco-socialist party will grow out of social movements and community of resistance, not the working class, as Marxists have traditionally believed. Others, and I'm one of them, disagree quite strongly with that view. In our view, socialism isn't possible without mass action by working people. But that doesn't mean that Joel and I can't work together. In fact, it's essential for this broad range of eco-socialists, we have a lot of views in the Earth movement, to figure out ways to collaborate and work together on current projects and concrete projects. And that's what the Eco-Socialist International Network is actually about. It's a framework for collaboration on a global scale among people who have a range of views, but who have a common view that capitalism is the problem and socialism is the solution. I hope we will be able to build similar cooperation in Canada. But I want to stress that at this point we are very far from the point where you can say this and this alone is eco-socialist theory. In fact, we may never reach that point. So if you're trying to read and find out what it's about, you really need to read a range of things because different authors do have different views in this. And then we come to eco-socialism as a movement. And I think this is really the most important meaning of that term. Because as Marx famously wrote, the philosophers have interpreted the world in various ways, but the point is to change it. Ultimately, eco-socialists will be judged not by the brilliance of their writing, but by what they actually do to change the world. Now, as you might expect, the eco-socialist movement varies an awful lot from country to country and is at very different stages in different countries. In countries like Canada and in Western Europe, the rise of eco-socialism reflects two parallel political developments, political trends. The spread of Marxist ideas in the Green Movement and the spread of ecological ideas in the Marxist left. These have taken place pretty much in parallel. What we're now seeing is a convergence of those two processes. The result is not, and I have to stress this, a new or separate movement. It's a current within existing socialist and green left movements, a current that seeks to win ecology activists to socialism and to convince socialists of the vital importance of ecological issues and struggles. You could say that in the global north, the central goal of eco-socialism today is to make the greens more red and the reds more green. I said that the last time I gave this talk, and a friend of mine came up to me afterwards, somebody whose views I strongly reflect, and he said, you know, what that really means is making the greens more green and the reds more red. Because what it's about is to convincing the greens that only profound social and economic change can achieve the green goal of sustainable ecologically balanced world. That is, to be really green, you have to be a socialist. And we aim to convince the socialists that real socialism requires a commitment to a sustainable, ecologically balanced world. In other words, you can't be a real socialist if you're not committed to ecology. And it won't be a real socialist society unless that's central to its operations. So as I say, eco-socialism doesn't compete with or replace existing ecology or socialist movements. What it tries to do is to extend, enhance, and complete both of those trends. That's typically what we're seeing in Europe, as I say, and in North America. But what I'm most excited about at this time is a phenomenon that has been gone largely unreported in the mass media. The rise of mass eco-socialist and anti-capitalist eco-socialist movements in the global south. For millions of people in the third world, global warming is a matter of life and death. Here you're not going to find people reading articles about reducing their carbon footprints. Their carbon footprints aren't actually very big. What they're doing is fighting environmental destruction of their lives, and they're fighting the environmental destroyers on a daily basis. These fights have taken many different forms. Land occupations to block the creation of plantations devoted to agrofuel or biofuel crops, such as soy or palm, in places like Paraguay, in Indonesia. Road blockades to demand expropriation of polluters in Ecuador. Sabotage of oil wells and pipelines in Mexico and Nigeria. Rallies and demonstrations, and all other astounding range of protests and activities going on daily. Just a month and a half ago in Peru, now to explain that, let me step back. In Peru, there is a law that says the government cannot approve a mine in an area where that's got agriculture without the approval of the local farmers. Now, in fact, the Peruvian government ignores that law all the time and is given the right to create mines, and particularly in indigenous areas of Peru, where they feel all those people, you know, they got no power anyhow, and the lands are being destroyed. In northern Peru, there's a proposal for a large-scale mine that is going to wipe out huge farming areas, and the government has refused to even hold the hearings it's supposed to hear. So what the local people did in that area was they organized their own referendum. And literally, and it was an astonishing thing, is that this hadn't happened before, because most of these people are very isolated. They're tiny villages way off in the mountains. And on the day of the referendum, people streamed into the towns. 60% of the people eligible showed up, almost all of them indigenous farmers, and over 90% voted against the mine. Now, we don't know if the Peruvian government's going to recognize the referendum. They denounced it as a communist plot. But nevertheless, it's indicative of the kind of ways people are organizing as anti-capitalist ecological movements in the global south. Protests like that are happening in dozens of countries, and we're going to see many more of them. Recently, we've seen something kind of new that's related to this. Most of us, I think, in this room are familiar with the mass struggles that have been going on in Latin American countries over the past few years, struggles that have led to the election of anti-imperialist governments in Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, Nicaragua. Less noticed has been the extent to which these anti-imperialist struggles are also pro-ecology struggles, and the extent to which the leaders of the ALBA, the international alliance that Venezuela and Cuba launched and which now involves Bolivia, Ecuador, the extent to which the leaders of the ALBA are taking the issue of global warming very seriously and incorporating ecological defense into their own programs for social and economic change. What's more, and really important about this, is the extent to which the leadership of this movement, in South America especially, is being taken by indigenous people. That indigenous people are in the front line of the fight. I quoted Evo Morales' letter to the UN a little bit earlier. And that letter, if you can, it's available at the Climate and Climate Capitalism site. If you haven't read it, you should. It's astonishing. It illustrates this point that in Latin America and the global south, the ideas of eco-socialism are part of the everyday discussion of socialists and anti-capitalists. Please read it. I was especially impressed by his suggestion for a global solution to global warming. And all these books that you read that say what we need is better light bulbs. Evo Morales says, we need to create a World Environment Organization which is binding and which can discipline the World Trade Organization, which is propelling us towards barbarism. Now, when I first read that, I thought it was sort of a clever turn of phrase, you know, a rhetorical flourish. But then you think about it, and the more politically astute that statement is, because in that one sentence, what Morales says is that international environmental protection has to have the force of law. And it has to, and he says it has to be more important, superior to capitalist profits and the neoliberal policies that sustain them. In short, he doesn't use the phrase, but he's calling for despotic inroads on the rights of property. It's a simple, crystal clear statement that's absolutely filled with pro-ecology
and anti-imperialist content. We're going to learn an awful lot from Evo Morales.
You are listening to Ian Angus, the well-known Canadian socialist writer and educator, speaking in Vancouver on November 16, 2007. This is CFRO Co-op Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver.
Cuba's foreign minister, Felipe Perez Roque, also spoke to the UN on the same day on global warming, and he made a particular stress of placing responsibility for global warming directly on the imperialist countries. And he rejected any idea, as we must, that poor countries should have to forego growth in order to clean up the mess caused by the rich countries. There is something truly immoral about people in countries as wealthy as Canada, the United States, and the governments of these countries saying they won't do anything until people in poverty-stricken countries act. Until people, you know, we've got our SUVs, you have to stop using oil. Truly an immoral position. Roque made that point very strongly, and he then went to the question of how are you going to finance mitigation and adaptation, because it isn't going to be cheap doing the cleanup and the changes. And because so much global warming is already inevitable because of what happened in the 20th century, there's going to be a lot that's going to have to be spent simply on rescuing people from the damage we cannot conceivably avoid in this century. So how are we going to pay for it? So Roque said, well, if we took half the money that the countries of the global south have to pay on servicing their debt every year, that would give us $200 billion a year for cleanup. They could use them. Well, this would not be charity. This would be people in the global south keeping their own money. Another example, he said, was let's just earmark a tenth of what the sole military superpower on the planet, the United States, spends on wars and weapons, and we would have another $50 billion a year. Let me add a footnote to that. Worldwide military spending is just over $1 trillion a year. Nicholas Stern, who did a big study for the British government on what it would cost if we acted right away to deal with global warming, he gave a cost in the realm of $620 billion. In other words, we could do it for a little over half the world's military budget. And that's a one-time cost. He's not talking about every year. That was his estimate. I think he underestimated. But even if he got it wrong by a factor of 10, the money's there if the political will were there. There's another really important feature of these growing third world battles against capitalist ecocide. Hugo Blanco was here in Vancouver speaking. You spoke with him a few weeks ago. Leader of the indigenous peasant movement in the Cusco area of Peru. And he writes, the native peoples of Abya Yala, the term for the Americas, as a whole feel deeply wounded by the egoistic and individualist culture and the assault on nature imposed by the multinational firms, because our culture is rooted in solidarity and love for nature. That's why we are on the front line of resistance and struggle against this culture that is attacking all humankind and nature in general. Blanco is an astonishing individual, a remarkable person, but this is not an isolated statement of one really bright man. This is an example of what's happening on a broad scale in Latin America today. Evo Morales, the first indigenous head of state, I said Latin America, but actually the first indigenous head of state since the invasion of 1492 in the Western Hemisphere. And he said the same thing in his speech at the UN. He said, we, the indigenous peoples and humble and honest inhabitants of this planet, believe that the time has come to put a stop to this, to rediscover our roots with respect for Mother Earth, with the Pachamama, as we call it in the Andes. Today, the indigenous people of Latin America and the world have been called upon by history to convert ourselves into the vanguard of the struggle to defend life, to nature and life. As I say, we have a lot to learn from Evo Morales. A couple of weeks ago, the Bolivian government, Morales' government, held a Congress of Indigenous Peoples in Bolivia. The Congress's main purpose was to mark the passing of the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. But it issued a manifesto, and if you have not picked up the new issue of Socialist Voice that was out on the table out there, please buy a copy. It's got the whole text of this resolution that came out of this conference. And it is remarkable. I don't think I've seen a document since the Declaration of Havana in the early 60s as powerful as this one. And it declared, "As a consequence of the neoliberal policy of domination of nature, the search for easy profits from the concentration of capital in a few hands and the irrational exploitation of natural resources, our Mother Earth is fatally injured, while the indigenous peoples are still being displaced from our territories. The struggle is unceasing. We will continue our resistance until our time comes. We proclaim the 12th of October." It's a date to remember in the future, folks. "We proclaim the 12th of October, the day of commencement of our struggles to save Mother Nature." Of course, it wasn't the commencement. They've been doing it for some time, but they're declaring this as an organized force. You know, in the socialist tradition, words like Mother Nature sound kind of weird. It's awfully soppy. But boy, it's powerful stuff. And we ought to learn to talk like that, because those words are right. The earth is what gave us all life, really. And that's a materialist statement. You can't say anything else about it. Here in Canada, it's no exaggeration to say that the First Nations people are far ahead of the rest of the left in initiating and carrying out effective campaigns against all kinds of capitalist destruction of the ecology. It's just some recent examples, and I could go on with great lists, but there is the successful campaign led by Sheila Watt-Cloutier of the Kalawit to persuade the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights to hear an unprecedented challenge. The commission has never done this before. An unprecedented challenge to U.S. policy on greenhouse gas emissions, charging that policy is violating the rights of the Inuit by destroying their way of life. The Inter-American, despite huge opposition from the U.S., the Inter-American Commission has agreed to hear that challenge. We have the recent occupation by two Algonquin bands of land near Charbot Lake, Ontario, quite close to where I live, to block uranium mining, which has forced the Ontario government to enter mediation, which they swore they wouldn't do. And we have the lawsuit recently filed by several Cree groups in Cree bands in northern Alberta against the provincial government and Shell Oil to stop the expansion of oil exploration that is destroying their lands and livelihood. In the last couple of days, there's been more of that. In August of this year, a delegation led by Continetta Horn of the Mohawk First Nation participated in an Indigenous Peoples Congress in Venezuela. Their greeting to that Congress was a powerful anti-colonialist pro-ecology statement. Continetta Horn wrote this, actually. "If everyone doesn't relearn how to look after the earth and each other, there will be nothing left for anyone to eat, no clean water to drink, no clean air to breathe. The colonial commercial exploitation of the environment has been taken to such extremes that human life itself is in peril." Any Canadian eco-socialist movement that deserves the name will not only support those movements, we will try to learn from them about how to express ourselves, how to organize and build those struggles. Now, before I move on to an outline of some of the tasks that are facing eco-socialists in the next while, I want to point out that my emphasis on Latin America doesn't mean that there's nothing happening in the rest of the third world. I picked Latin America because I think it's very exciting and near to us. But there are major battles against ecological devastation taking place in Africa and Asia as well. I could spend hours here, by the way, just talking about the fight against the spread of industrial farms and plantations that are geared to agri-fuel, biofuel production in Central Africa, Indonesia, Malaysia, India, and elsewhere. The size and scope of the devastation that biofuel plantations are creating is astonishing. And the horrifying thing about this is that it's largely taking place because Europe and North America think they're going to solve their petroleum problems by using oil from plants. The destruction of forests to build these plantations creates more greenhouse gases than the biofuel could ever conceivably save. And it's largely taking place by the method of creating giant industrial farms and driving traditional peasants and traditional people off of their lands. The size of the plantations, I have relatives who are farmers in Canadian prairies, and they have farms that people in Ontario would think are gigantic,
They have, you know, several, you know, multiple sections. I get up into several square miles of farms with wheat and whatever on them. But here we are talking about farms that are hundreds of square miles. Hundreds and hundreds in some cases. Where the traditional crops have been destroyed and they're all turned over to monocultures to grow soy or palm in order to drive the cars in North America. And there are big battles going on in many countries against that. I focused on Latin America in part because our time is limited, but above all because the formation of the ALBA bloc of anti-imperialist governments is a huge step forward for eco-socialists and a huge step forward for the entire international left. So what are we going to do? Canadian Dimension magazine asked me to write an article on what eco-socialists should be doing now, and the issue is on the stands. My article is there, so you can get that. But I identified several areas that I think we should be focusing on. This is just a quick outline. As I say, the article is in the current issue of Canadian Dimension, or it's available on the Capitalism and Climate website. The first thing is that we need to get out of the ivory tower and start getting involved in actual action. In North America, in particular, the development of eco-socialist ideas has occurred almost entirely in academic circles. We really need to learn to explain our ideas outside of the academy. I'm hoping very strongly that in the coming year we'll be able to produce some articles and pamphlets that make the case in language real people can understand. Pretty much by definition, regular people don't read academic journals. Academics practically don't read academic journals. For anybody who wants really good examples of how to do this, the Australian newspaper Green Left Weekly, in my opinion, is one of the best newspapers in the world for dealing with these subjects. They're on the web, and they do a tremendous job of issue after issue dealing with real issues, explaining them, not watering down the ideas, but explaining them clearly. We need to learn from that. Analysis and theory and pamphlets, good things to have, but actual change is only going to come through action. Eco-socialists need to learn to ally ourselves with anyone and everyone who organizes actions that protest and expose both the corporate polluters and their parliamentary representatives. And we need to be active participants in those actions. In particular, December the 8th of this year has been declared an international day of protest on global warming. It's specifically set to coincide with the next big UN conference in Bali, which is the meeting to decide what to do when the Kyoto Treaty expires in 2012. And there are protests going on all over the world. There are people beginning to organize in Canada. It's a fairly small scale here. This originated in England. But this is something we should be working on and building. One of the most important contributions that eco-socialists can make to the broader green movement is a clear focus on the rights of working people. The workers in the tar sands and power plants are not responsible for greenhouse gases, and they shouldn't lose one penny when their bosses are forced to clean up their acts. Sadly, the green movement has not understood this well. It's been a strong tendency to blame the people who work in those places, and even if it's not blame, what I see again and again is I hear people saying, shut down the tar sands, with no discussion of what happens to the thousands of people who work there and who work in related industries or in stores or whatever in those areas. At the very least, a big part of the socialist involvement in this should be insisting on comprehensive retraining programs, fully subsidized relocation programs, all at full union pay, with no loss of benefits or pensions, as we begin to reorganize the economy to not produce greenhouse gases. At the same time, the eco-socialist current can play a critical role in persuading organized labor to get involved in the fight against climate change, to give the lie to capitalist claims that working people have no stake in saving the world.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You're listening to Ian Angus on eco-socialism.
The third area
that I think we should be focusing on should be clear from the talk I've given. We should be aligning ourselves with indigenous movements and promoting global justice as an integral part of the fight against climate change. The president of Uganda has accurately called global warming an act of aggression by the rich against the poor. There can be no question about which side we are on in that war. The First Nations in Canada are showing the way forward in the fight against capitalist ecocide. Socialists, eco-socialists should be among the strongest supporters of those protests, whatever form they may take. And at the same time, we need to recognize and support the leadership role that Indigenous people in the Third World are playing. We have to reject any suggestion that the Global South should be expected to forgo economic growth in order to solve a problem that was created by the North. In fact, the countries we live in, the northern imperialist countries, owe an immense ecological debt to the countries of the Global South. And that concept of an ecological debt needs to be understood and promoted in the North. It's certainly very clearly understood in the South. We have a political and a moral duty to demand that that debt be paid promptly and in full. A central feature of our work has to be publicizing pro-ecology movements in the Third World, building solidarity campaigns, providing concrete aid when we can. And as a small example, Climate and Capitalism is a supporter of the recently organized Lucha Indigena Solidarity Network. It's a group that raises money and other material support for Lucha Indigena, that's that newspaper, which is edited by the Peruvian socialist leader Hugo Blanco, who I quoted earlier. This is a very new project, but one I'm feeling quite optimistic about. And this is the kind, small scale, but some of the things we need to do. I started out this talk with a quote from the president of Bolivia, Evo Morales. So it seems to me it's appropriate to close with Evo Morales. This is from his speech to the UN on September the 24th. I feel that it is important to organize an international movement to deal with the environment, a movement that will be above institutions, businesses, and countries that just talk about commerce, that only think about accumulating capital. We have to organize a movement that will defend life, defend humanity, and save the earth. In those words, President Morales summed up the challenge facing eco-socialists, indeed the challenge facing anybody who cares about our world. It isn't enough to criticize the way the world is today. We need to build a movement that can change it. And if we respond effectively, then together we can stop capitalism from making the earth uninhabitable. Thank you.
That was Eco-Socialism, Where Anti-Capitalism and Ecology Intersect, by Ian Angus. The speech follows the first International Eco-Socialist meeting in Paris on October 7th and 8th, where the Eco-Socialist International Network was founded. This speech was recorded November 16th, 2007, at Simon Fraser University, Vancouver, by Radio EcoShock. Find out more about Ian Angus and the alternatives to capitalism at his blog, Climate and Capitalism. That's at www.climateandcapitalism.blogspot.com. You're tuned to CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Well, we just have time for a couple of tidbits from Ian Angus. Here are a couple of answers that he gave to questions from the audience at the SFU Downtown Center in Vancouver. Here is Ian Angus.
The capitalist system, I mean, the real capitalist system, as opposed to various utopian ones that get described in books, is a system in which profit is not just an accidental feature and not something you just shift around, but a fundamental characteristic of the system. Capital is money that has to grow. That's what capital is. If I invest capital in any environment, assuming it doesn't matter whether I'm a good person or a bad person or a nice person or an evil person, the reason I invest $10 is because I'm hoping to get back $11. And in fact, if I don't, the system will fall apart.
And if I get back 11, what do I do with it? I reinvest it to get 12. And what I'm really hoping for, and what in fact occurs, is exponential growth. Because if I do it at 10% every time, I'm pretty soon into enormous amounts if I succeed in growing all the time. And the things that interrupt me are wars and depressions. But the system works that way. The result is that capitalism ultimately puts exponential pressure on the environment. It has to use more and more resources. And its method of using them is extraordinarily destructive. There was a study done a few years ago. You can find it on the web, but the study was called The Weight of the Earth. And some scientists and economists got together and examined advanced capitalist countries. They're basically examining industrialized countries. And what they were looking at was inputs and outputs. What is used, what are the natural resources and so on that are used to make things, and what are the outputs on the other side, and how do you measure them? And the truly astonishing number that comes out of their study, comparing natural resource inputs, what comes out the other side, between 50 and 75% of resource inputs that go into production in the industrialized nations end up as waste within 12 months. That is, they go into landfills, they go into the rivers, they go into the air. We get living in a society. Why does that happen? Because capitalism does not pay for nature. It uses it. It treats it as an infinite supply of free resources. It does not pay the cost of cleaning the air. It doesn't pay the cost of cleaning the rivers. And of course, it doesn't pay the cost of replacing the oil and the coal and all the rest of the things that it uses up. It treats our atmosphere and our water as a giant toilet and dumps the waste into it. Now, could we solve that somehow? Well, I think we can. The solution is socialism. Would socialism involve continuing opportunities for people to be entrepreneurial, to find ways to create new, to meet new human needs in new and exciting ways? I sure hope so. My vision of socialism doesn't involve somebody sitting in Ottawa saying, you will produce 12 of these next week, and that's the only thing you're allowed to do. Marx talked about socialism as opening up all the opportunities of human creativity. And I think part of that will involve forms of competition in which people try to do better than other people. That's a thing we love to do. It doesn't mean we've got to wreck the environment to do it or put down other people to do it. But I think we will ultimately come up with different definitions of growth than we now have, and expansion. And a lot of them will involve more free time. A lot of it will involve not spending $1 trillion a year on military resources. A lot of it will not involve, by the way, if this, you know, I love when capitalist economists tell us that this whole system is built on, well, it's just human nature. You know, everybody wants more all the time. That's the way the system works. If that was the truth, why would they have to spend hundreds of billions of dollars every year convincing us to buy things? Why do we need an advertising industry whose purpose is not to deal with needs but to create wants? We wouldn't need that if this was just inherent in human behavior. And that's wonderful to hear that there are people doing that. And in fact, one of capitalism's strengths, to be perfectly honest, as a system, is that capitalism will find a way to make a buck out of absolutely anything. And it will make a buck out of being green if it can. And I have no particular objection to that part of it. Unfortunately, most of those activities take place around the margins in relatively small activities. You know, ultimately you discover that Lululemon doesn't really use seaweed in their t-shirts. Or worse, you discover that all the salmon aren't coming back this year because we've heated the oceans up enough that they're not feeding properly. Even if it were possible through the process of creating small firms that would gradually get bigger, we haven't got time.
We don't have the century that, you know, assuming that could happen, I don't believe it could, but assuming it could, we're talking about a century of economic activity to get to that point, and our problem is way more urgent than that.
For the wrong reasons, not a way forward.
That's right. Now, finally, you asked about how do we deal with, you know, number one, impeaching these people who are doing these things in the third world. There's actually, in particular in Europe, the ecology movement and the green lefts on the left greens in England have been, and in Europe have been doing some very impressive work, because the European Union, in order, you know, all these governments that want to look like they're doing something but aren't, what they really pushed biofuel as this is going to be the way we will solve the problem of emissions. And the European Union has actually issued quotas. All these countries have to use a certain amount of biofuel a year, and products, you know, and the gasoline companies and so on have to include that much biofuel. So there's quite a substantial movement developing in Europe just to reverse this process, to demand that the quotas be removed, to demand, in fact, that they impose barriers against the import of biofuel. Now, again, this is really it's complicated, because what we've had back from the EU is, we have now got a program under which we check and make sure that it's really okay the way they make it. Oh, yeah. It's like, well, they made their opium entirely organically, so it must be good. How do we counter the propaganda? Well, we do this sort of thing. We write about it. We talk about it. But you know who the best ally we actually have is? Ultimately, our best ally is the capitalist system, because the contradiction between what they say and what they do is getting bigger every year.
Well, that was Ian Angus speaking on November 16th, 2007 at the SFU campus downtown on eco-socialism. That's it for the Local Brown Bagger this week. Hope to have you back next Tuesday at noon for another great speech from Vancouver. We go out with a taste of new Canadian music. This is Small Sin with I Need a Friend. Yeah, I